Last week we discussed something of the legendary and lore behind Wagner's great cycle of the Ring. And this evening we must approach the New Testament of this epic, the Wagnerian cycle of the Grail. And as in the previous cycle, he drew heavily upon what might be termed folklore, but particularly upon the legends of the troubadours. We have tried at various times in lectures and books to tell you something about the troubadours. These mysterious singers and ballad writers who have been passed off largely as a band of wandering minstrels, but who actually represented a very closely integrated, highly organized group of men with very deep and real spiritual, philosophical, and even political activities in the backs of their minds. The troubadours seem to have inherited something of the mysteries of the ancient Orphic bards. And like the Druidic bards, they were not only the perpetuators of ancient tales, but they composed a great many, or created new patterns and arrangements by which they deepened and broadened the implications of folklore and legendary. At a time when frank statement was impossible, these priests of secret cults exercised a tremendous influence in Europe, and many of the great epics which have descended to us as the priceless examples of early medieval literature are traceable directly to them, and upon the tremendous store of lore which they left, countless more recent dramas, stories, legends have been built. Now, in the case of the Parsifal story, we know that we are dealing with a very definite collection of these cyclic myths, a collection which includes not only the Parsifal Lohengrin stories, but also the entire cycle known as the Arthurian legend, or the story of the Age of Chivalry, and much, if not all, of the legend of Roland and the paladins of Charlemagne, King of the Franks. We have in the cycles of these legends many implications of deeper and double meanings, but only from the perspective of a more enlightened era can we examine in some detail the interlocking of these stories. We have to therefore assume that while it is not impossible that the Arthurian cycle had a certain foundation in history, that it was largely an embellishment, perhaps some small and inconsequential group of events became the basis of that great cycle which Tennyson has preserved for us in the Idylls of the King. The same is true of the story of Charlemagne. The historical Charles the Great is not in every way the Charlemagne of the epic cycle. It is quite possible that there may be some historical foundation for the Lohengrin epic in Belgium, and there is perhaps a remote historical ground for the great cycle of Parsifal. Actually, however, these historical elements are of no great importance. They have so completely submerged in the larger meaning that it is scarcely necessary to re-identify them. For practical purposes, we of course realize that the Grail cycle, as Wagner took hold of it, was a scattered group of works. Several, particularly the Titurel stories, arising in Germany and actually traceable directly to the great bardic singers of the troubadours. While mentioning this, we might also note that St. Francis of Assisi was also a troubadour. So was Petrarch, Dante, and Boccaccio. All of these men, therefore, may be suspected, and their writings are always suspect. To take the writings of Dante, for example, when he explains how he climbs out of the pits of the underworld on the body of Satan, this seems like wild fantasy. And his romantic childhood attachment for Beatrice, appears to be merely the story of a very emotional and impressionable youth. But behind all these things are other intents. And as we begin to penetrate them, we realize why it was necessary and how it was necessary in those days of tremendous mental oppression to hide very choice and important truths in these fables and myths. The story of the Grail cycle begins apparently at the time when the Roman Emperor Vespasian was laying siege to the city of Jerusalem. At that time, he was assisted by the leaders and upholders and followers of a group or tribe called the Cenobordan. This family was of unknown origin, but from a study of the names of the sons and relatives of the house, we may suspect an Arabic background. Now, this is all the more interesting when we discover that the oldest form that we have of the Parsifal story came from the Arabs of Spain during a certain period in their sphere of cultural influence. One time, of course, they dominated all European thought. This Cenobordan family intermarried with the nobility of Europe, and as a result of the help given to the Roman Emperor, they became a powerful family after the establishment of the Holy Roman Empire. And among the descendants of this family, after several generations, was Titurel, the first king of the Grail. Now, this man is also subjected to a wide cycle of myths, and historically, almost nothing is known about him. He is tied in, however, by the troubadours into other cycles other than the Grail cycle, and occurs for us in a number of different forms and appearances. It is said that this was the one, however, this great and noble prince, who received a vision from heaven instructing him to build the great temple for the Grail. And he was told by angelic voices where to select the place and how to go about this wonderful project to which he was predestined and foreordained. The place selected was said to have been on the mountains between Christian and Muslim Spain, in a location difficult to establish, although efforts have been made to give it historical orientation. Anyway, this palace was called the Palace on Mount Salvat, and apparently it was patterned after the concept of the mysterious Lodge of the Adepts in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia. Now, you might think that such a thing would be a long way from the thinking of Christian Europe, even in the days of the troubadours. But we know that the Mongols, even before the time of Genghis Khan, had been quite active in trading along the caravan routes with Europe, and many strange and interesting legends, bits of folklore, tales, had come along these routes. Among them, many that later show up in the journals of Columbus, who seems to have been very sensitive to this type of thinking. In any event, the contact between Europe and Asia was not as thin as we think. As a result of a council of the churches much earlier, the Nestorian Christians had been declared heretical and had been sent into the desert and wilderness with the hope that they would perish. These Nestorians, however, were able to survive, and they carried on and they journeyed into far places. And there are Christian monuments today in China, raised before the 5th century, bearing witness to the presence of Nestorian missionaries. Thus, there was a direct contact between the Near East and the Mediterranean and China as early as the 2nd century AD, a contact which led to a considerable exchange of art, culture, literature, even music and language. This is not any more surprising, of course, than the still earlier contact established in India, particularly in the Gandhara region, as a result of the expeditions of Alexander the Great. So the East and West were not as strange or separate as Kipling might cause us to believe. And the contacts and legends of these two regions were fairly well established. During the reign of Kublai Khan, the illustrious descendant of the great Genghis, a delegation was sent to the Pope from Mongolia. This delegation visited the Pope while he was enthroned in Avignon as a result of one of the eternal ecclesiastical feuds that were dividing the church at that time. This delegation told him, among other things, that there existed in Asia at that time a Christian empire, a very strange and mysterious place, ruled over by John the Presbyter, a very mysterious and elusive person. And John the Presbyter himself sent epistles to the Pope, to the Doge of Venice, to the Dukes of Florence, and to many other important persons of his time, always signing himself John the Presbyter, King of Kings, Emperor of all the world. Now this modest title, of course, he came by legitimately because that was also the official title of Genghis Khan, who very nearly made it a fact. If it hadn't been for a poor little country that is now having a lot of trouble, Hungary, he probably would have been king of Europe as well as of Asia. In any event, this mysterious John the Presbyter was a force to conjure with, and he had quite a part to play in the development of America, inasmuch as the early voyagers seeking a new route to Asia were primarily concerned in visiting the court of Prester John, King of Kings, Emperor of all the world. Now this man was so fabled in his glory and his greatness that it is said that he lived in a wonderful world surrounded by a desert of gold. And in this sea of gold and sand swam fishes of emeralds and jade and silver. And he was served by a tremendous retinue. 72 kings were his body servants. 144,000 dukes waited on him. And his chefs consisted of 72 bishops. He really had quite an establishment out there somewhere. The only difficulty is no one was ever able to find it. And although the letters and messages which he sent are still in existence, no one ever discovered who Prester John was or what his mysterious empire was like. We are not surprised, therefore, that he arises in the songs of the troubadours. And Prester John plays a very important part in our Grail story, as we will see in a moment. But anyway, in the great cycle of Roland, the story of the hero of the court of Charlemagne, the Sir Galahad, the Robin Hood, the Siegfried of the Charlemagne cycle, we learn of the wonderful help that Prester John sent to Charlemagne. And we learn also that by magic, heroes traveled through the air to visit the empire of Prester John. It was all very curious, all very secret, and much in the spirit of the strange things reported by Apollonius of Tyana when he returned from India, or the even stranger and more wonderful things described by Sir Marco Polo in his experiences. Polo's stories of the magic, mystery, sorcery, and wonder of the East, these stories were considered so extravagant that on his deathbed he was asked to recant and correct his extravagances in order that he might not go into the other world as a branded liar. Marco Polo on his deathbed said he'd only told half the story, and the only way he could go into the other world as a liar was by taking back what he had said. So the fate of Sir Marco in the other world is still open to some controversy. But all these legends seemingly had a pattern. They have a place in the world, because after Parsifal had finished his kingship of the Grail, it is said in one of the most serious of the great stories that he journeyed to the East and took the cup to the court of Prester John, where it has remained forever since. Also, when the time came for the great King Titurel to die, after he had ruled the Grail Kingdom for 400 years, it is said that before he passed, he also journeyed to the East and returned to the kingdom of Prester John. Thus, this peculiar combination of myths interblends, ties together, and seems to make quite a story. Now, the story of the Grail section of this, for a moment, is also a wonderful and fantastic story. In the first place, we have in the old writings of the troubadours two forms of the term or statement signifying the Grail. We have the Sangre Real, which literally means the blood of the king. And we have the Sangreal, which means the holy cup. These terms are interused in a very strange way, seemingly indicating two distinct meanings. Where the cup came from originally, of course, is a matter also of controversy. Obviously, it is much older than the Last Supper, because it occurs in the rites and rituals of the Druids. It is almost certainly the mysterious cup of Dionysus, the cup of, or chalice of ecstasy. It appears in an entirely different form in the cup of the guildmasters of Europe. And it returns again and again in the different legends. When you go back through the poems and songs of the troubadours, you find several very interesting things. In one of these things, the Holy Grail is described not as a cup but a book. This is a peculiar implication that might take further analysis. In another work, it is described as an oracle, and it is said that a voice spoke from it, revealing all the mysteries of the world. In most instances, however, it is regarded as some kind of a drinking vessel, often associated with song, sometimes with a magic cauldron, such as that of the ancient British deity Ceridwen, whose magic cauldron, like the kettle of the witches of Macbeth, was used for divers purposes. This cauldron also occurs as the mysterious skull cup of the ancient Nordic mysteries, from which the neophyte for initiation drank of the blood of the god. This cup containing the cleansing blood goes back into nearly all of the old religions of the world. There is a Kabbalistic legend, which incidentally also began in southern Spain during a period in which Muslim tolerance permitted a very powerful growth of Jewish mysticism, that this cup was originally taken from an emerald called Exilus and had been the crown jewel of the archangel Lucifer and was struck from his head by the sword of Michael at the time of the war in heaven. This goes back to a period in which documentation will be extremely difficult. Therefore, we can only report such things as are told of this matter. This cup as a green jewel did have quite a long history, however, and during the Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon I was in a position to examine what was originally believed to be the original green cup of the taken from the crest jewel of Lucifer. He had it brought to Paris and examined by experts, and they discovered that it was green glass and of not too ancient a manufacture, so that the relic might be open to some controversy also. But in any event, the Kabbalistic legend is that this stone falling from heaven was concealed beneath the surface of the earth and became the foundation of the footstool of the world. It is quite an involved story, but it seems to suggest that in some way it represented a great power, knowledge, or mystery, that like the famous stone cables of the Mosaic Law, which were originally said to have been sapphires, that this stone had its religious place because it became the foundation upon which man built his quest for spiritual growth. In other words, man, having followed the fallen angel, built upon the mysterious foundation of this green jewel. And upon this, he was to build his way back to heaven. All these legends are not directly related to Parsifal, but they belong very closely with the story. The actual story itself, as developed by Wagner, is like the Ring, an interesting combination of the legends of the troubadours and a private, personal brand of Wagnerian mythology. As in the other instances, he selected what he wanted and what he could use. In commenting upon this peculiarity, Bailey, who was a great student of these symbols and related matters, said that in his estimation, if ever an ancient troubadour was reborn, it was Richard Wagner, because he had the same strange, wonderful gift as Achenbach and many of the others of creating what was useful to him, and to bring all these elements together to tell a new story and a new picture. Now, one thing you will observe always, especially if you have attended the opera, you will realize that Parsifal, as an opera, is about the nearest thing in music drama to what might be termed a high mass. It is a very highly religious thing, and is usually given at the Metropolitan in New York at least once on Good Friday every year. The Good Friday spell is certainly strengthened by the use of this tremendous mystical opera. Yet the more you analyze the opera, the more you realize that you are not dealing with Orthodox Christianity at all. You're not dealing with the background that you might expect to find. You are dealing with what one English author has referred to as the secret church of the Holy Grail. And this secret church of the Holy Grail is a general term now applied to our concept of mysticism. Back in the early days, when the church was still an all-powerful physical institution, there was already a division within the body of the believers. This division was, of course, encouraged and strengthened by what were called the heretics, or those who had never really accepted the orthodox overtones of the church. These heretics involved the descendants of the Greek scholars that had once flourished in Rome. They represented the various religions that the Roman Empire had conquered. They represented merchants and travelers and statesmen from non-Christian countries who, for one reason or another, took up temporary abode within the boundaries of Christendom. And they represented, in general, an instinct on the part of man, an instinct to search for the internal experience of God, rather than to depend entirely upon the ministrations of a clergy. We remember the line in which the great general enters the porch of the temple, and the priest meets him. And the priest stands as though to bar the way. And the great general says, "Whose house is this?" And the priest says, "This is the house of God, sire." The general said, "Then, man, step aside. I shall go my own way." Now, in some way, this spirit rose strongly in Europe, perpetuating the heresy of Manes, perpetuating the Muslim contact on the fringe of Christendom, the old Egyptian mysteries, which still survived as philosophical institutions. And in the early church, there did arise a powerful stream of mysticism. This mysticism was distinctly unorthodox. It was dedicated to the fact that each human being had within himself the power to seek inwardly for the source of light and truth, and that mysteriously and wonderfully, his own heart was the matchless altar of his soul, and that in his heart he could commune with God. And we realize gradually that the Grail became the symbol of the inner sanctuary of the human heart, within which flows forever the blood of life. And that the Grail, therefore, was the secret altar which man, as priest, served in his own nature without benefit of clergy. This matchless altar, this wonderful internal mystery, attracted not only those within Christendom, but also divided the Orthodox individual from a band of mystics who were always outside of the orthodoxy of the Church. Sometimes they appeared to conform. Sometimes, as in the case of the Minnesang and the Meistersingers, they actually held their meetings within the cathedrals and churches. No one suspected exactly what was behind it all. But one interesting and wonderful thing you will note in this whole great cycle, whether it be in Charlemagne or the Arthurian legend or in the Grail story of Parsifal. Although Parsifal is a completely religious drama, no member of the clergy is introduced at any time. There is no priest. The King of the Grail himself plays the part of the priest, raises the cup in the Eucharistic ceremony, and therefore the great order of chivalry in total represented a laity priesthood, or a priestly laity, that performed their various secret rites and their holy sacraments without the cooperation or presence of the vested clergy. This is a very important point, because it has to do with the descent of mysticism, which carries all the way down through the medieval period into the Kabbalists, the Rosicrucians, the Alchemists, the Illuminists, and finally down into what we would term today the metaphysicians, or those who are studying various religious beliefs as individuals and seeking to grow from within themselves according to their own personal needs. This mysterious Church of the Holy Grail was therefore gradually assumed to be the true repository of the esoteric Christian doctrine. It was supposed to be the soul or the spirit or the hidden body which had the true doctrine, which it had received from the Gnosis, from the Neoplatonists, and from all the secret societies of the ancient world, from the mysteries, which alone possessed the true keys to the sacred rites and ceremonies. We therefore find in the story of the knight errant, whether it be in Lohengrin or Parsifal or King Arthur's Circle, we find that the knight performs his vigil. And like the initiates of ancient mysteries, he was always divided into three grades or orders. Incidentally, the same thing existed exactly in China. And I'm doing some research now on the Heaven-Earth Association, or the Hong Society, which also divides in precisely the same way, has the same objectives, and is also distinguished by the absolute absence of clergy. So here on the opposite side of the world was a precisely identical phenomenon. The three orders of the Grail, or the three orders of the Arthurian cycle, were called the orders of the page, of the squire, and of the knight. The page began his training, began his preparation for a life of knighthood. Later he was elevated to the condition or state of a squire, and accompanied his master or the knight to whom he was assigned on various labors and purposes. And finally, after appropriate interval and time, he was knighted and became a true and full-fledged member of this order of chivalry. He advanced not only by valuable service and by conscientious learning of the things we might associate with the feudal system of aristocracy. He advanced by study, by various dedications, and by various renunciations. For instance, during the great age of the temple, when the Knights Templars of Jerusalem were advancing in their way to become a great world power, no knight of the temple was permitted to own anything. He had to go back to the vow of absolute poverty. He had to spend practically all of his spare time doing one of two things, polishing his armor or praying to his God. Those were his labors. By polishing his armor, he proved that he was ever watchful and vigilant to the duties and labors of chivalry. And the rest of the time, he lived as a monk, having no earthly possessions, not permitted even to play cards or to play chess or checkers or any game that was fashionable at the time. He could only polish his armor and pray to his God. So these orders were not quite as flamboyant as Mark Twain's account of King Arthur's court might imply. They were really very serious. And we may also add that these knights were not constantly engaged in the glorious exploit of killing dragons and rescuing damsels in distress. There simply just wasn't that many dragons, and there were not so many damsels in distress at that time. All these legends are purely stories to conceal the great purposes of knighthood. And these purposes, again, take on another group of symbolisms and become the labors of alchemy 200 or 300 years later. All these are stories of human beings seeking truth. Therefore, all these knightly and chivalrous orders are grouped together under the title Orders of the Quest. They were groups of individuals seeking truth according to the dictates of their own conscience, seeking it within themselves, seeking it in far and distant places, not by traveling out to hunt for dragons, but to seek the wise and the good in various parts of the world. But they were always alert and ready with their polished and sharpened weapons to fight the three great monsters which at that time burdened all the world, these monsters being ignorance, superstition, and fear. These were their tasks, and they were the leaders and vanguards of the great humanistic movements that were later to come forth in the positive and outward preachments of Rousseau, Voltaire, and Thomas Paine. These were the defenders of the rights of man against church and state, against any enemy that sought to prevent the human being from growing according to nature's laws and nature's will. So the legends sprang up around these principles, and of course we would naturally expect them to take their place in the Parzival account. Now Parzival occupies a rather complicated situation when you come to analyze him. The drawing of his character by Wagner is quite confused. In the early part of the story, he is presented to us as the guileless one, or as some rather mistakenly call him, the fool. Actually, Parzival was not the fool in the sense of one stupid, but rather he was the pure of heart who had not yet discovered worldliness, who had not experienced deceit or evil as we know it. He certainly, however, was not exactly a brilliant or informed person. And the first introduction we have to him in the opera is where, with his little bow and arrow, he shoots the swan and kills it. The swan, which is the symbol of the bird of great verse. The swan in ancient times was the ancient symbol of extrasensory perception, or the intuitive faculties of human consciousness. Therefore, in the killing of the swan, Parzival has in some way blunted or dulled his own internal vision. This is the implication of the story. By the time in which the story opens, we have a whole cast of characters arranged for our consideration. We have Parzival, the one who knew not where he came from, who he was, or who his parents were. He knew only that his mother was the sorrow of the world, and his father he had never known. He knew also that in some mysterious way, through his mother, he was associated with this great family of the Son of Borden, because actually Parzival belonged to what was called the stem of the Grail Kings. Within him was the same blood that was in Titurel and Amfortas. But he did not know this because he had wandered far. So we have a new story now, and if we watch the descent or generations of the Grail Kings, we will find that they parallel exactly the older Nibelungen account of the descent of the Volsungs. Because the Grail Kings, the stem of the Grail, is the stem of the redeeming power. And as the Volsungs represented the descent or involutionary processes of consciousness, the Cenobordan, the great stem of the Grail, represents the evolutionary development of the entire story of human growth and the unfoldment of man's internal spiritual faculties. At the time when Parsifal appears, Amfortas is king of the Grail. Now Amfortas is introduced in the opera, carried upon a litter by knights because he has passed through a terrible and grievous injury. It seems that some time before, following an ancient Persian belief that light and darkness cannot exist apart, that when the magnificent temple at Mount Salvat was built upon the peak of the mountains, another strange and mysterious palace was built in the depth of the valley nearby. And this was built by enchantment and sorcery and magic, and was ruled over by a strange eastern magician who is called in the opera Klingsor, who is the adversary. He is the symbol of illusion, delusion, worldliness. He is the prince of this world, referred to by Christ, who has nothing in truth. And in order to be truly a first-class black magician, Klingsor had built a weir, a magic net, or a magic garden, a thing to capture human souls. And he had made it very beautiful, and he had populated it with mysterious beings that were like the Peris and Uris of the Arabian Nights entertainment. Mysterious, fabulous creatures. Beautiful, so-called flower maidens. And I would like to point out that in the last 25 years, there's been a marked improvement in the flower maidens at the Metropolitan Opera. Up to that time, most of the flower maidens were chosen from rather buxom Teutonic sopranos and assorted groups, and were dressed in flowing gossamer that was really a little the worse for having been stored away in the Met for a number of years. But after a while, in more recent years, some new mind and life came into the Metropolitan, and now we have seen the last 8 or 9 years a very careful reconstruction of Wagner's original concept. The flower maidens are now all in Oriental costumes, resembling as closely as possible the characters from the Arabian Nights entertainment with which they are associated. And Klingsor himself emerges like the magician of Aladdin's lamp, as a definitely sinister Asiatic, rather than as a rather medieval magician, the type with the tall pointed black hat and the black robe covered with stars, which has more or less passed out of fashion. But both of these groups have greatly improved with a little thought, and the story takes on much more of its original and intended coloring. Now in the Grail Castle were kept the two great relics of the Grail mystery, associated with the mystery of the Passion of Christ. One was the Sangreal, or the cup of the Last Supper. Others say it is the cup that caught the blood of Christ when he was hanging on the cross. This is the cup that is supposed to have been held by Joseph of Arimathea. And it is the result of this phase of the legend that we have the rise of the great cycle at Glastonbury. And it is said that Joseph of Arimathea, accompanied by the sister of Saint Veronica, carried the cup and other relics, including the crown of thorns, to Britain, where they were placed in the crypt of the old church that stood where later Glastonbury was built. It is this search for the Glastonbury chalice which has involved a number of grail expeditions in the past, and it is said that the wreath of thorns was planted in the ground and has resulted in a peculiar plant called the Glastonbury thorn, which grows presumably particularly at that place. Of course, the handkerchief of St. Veronica is interesting because it is another case where we have confused names. The so-called lady, St. Veronica, actually isn't a person at all. The name is Veronica is from Vera Icon, which means the true likeness or the true appearance of the face of the Master. We know that in the Eastern Church they have their icons or pictures of saints, and the Vera Icon is the true likeness and has gradually been corrupted into Veronica. In any event, this cup and the spear of Longinus, the centurion whose spear pierced the side of Christ, the cup of the Last Supper or of the blood of Christ, the legends are not clear, and as I told you, they've spelled the word two ways, so that's very confusing. These are supposed to have been brought to Monsalvat and placed in the great sanctuary of the Grail Temple. After a number of knights and squires and pages had wandered down from the top of the great mountain temple and had become ensnared in the wiles of Klingsor and his enchanted garden, Amfortas felt called upon to rid his knightly region of this menace. So he took the spear of Longinus and descended into the valley to do battle with Klingsor. And when he arrived there, he hurled the spear. But because of the fact that this in itself was a strange desecration of this sacred instrument, it did not reach its mark. Instead, Klingsor grasped the spear, turned, and wounded Amfortas with it. This was a very terrible thing because it was a wound that would not heal. And the Grail King returned to his castle with this bleeding wound that never completely healed and bled profusely, almost fatally, every year at Good Friday. The story of this wound seems to tell us, in a simple moral way, that we cannot use good with which to do evil even in the name of good. Amfortas should never have attempted with violence to destroy Klingsor, because he merely did what we all do when we seek revenge. He made another evil. And two evils, or two evil actions, will not equal a right one. So Amfortas was punished for his audacity in using the spear for a purpose of destruction, even to destroy evil. So when Parsifal arrives on the scene, in the drama, Amfortas is already wounded, suffering from this terrible injury that will not heal. Now at the time also, there was a grand old knight there, a wonderful old sage, scholar, counselor, wise man, who is called Gunamans. And this man is the teacher of the young pages and squires. And he is a venerable man who is particularly remembered for the fact that he is able to sing for nearly 45 minutes, apparently without taking his breath. Some of his numbers to the uninitiated become, shall we say, slightly tedious. But in any event, he is a wonderful person, and probably the tedium is that which all school children suffer from whenever they are expected to learn anything. But anyway, Gunamans is able to tell Parsifal the story of the Grail and to explain to him the terrible curse that hangs over it as the result of the wounding of Amfortas. And he also tells him something of a prophecy, that there is one to come who, like Galahad in the Arthurian cycle, is the pure of heart, the one in whom there is no evil, the one who is to be called the guileless one, the one who does good simply from being good, and about whom there is a legend that when he appears, he will restore the glory of the Grail Empire. Now we learn as we go into both the Wagnerian and the old troubadour's accounts that the Grail Castle on Mount Salvat is not just a place where these knights gather for the great sacraments of Good Friday and Easter. This is the center or the capital of an invisible empire. And except when they are present for the great ceremony of the Eucharist, the Knights of the Grail go forth to all parts of the world, serving human beings in every region and in every land. And they are bound together, and they have many pages and squires. And this forms an invisible network of good. They answer the prayers of the needy and of the sick and the afflicted, and they champion the cause of right wherever they can. And this occurs, of course, in the story of Lohengrin. For when the poor young lady is in great need and falls on her knees praying for a champion to protect her and to see that right is done, then this swan knight comes out of the unknown in his little boat and becomes her champion. And these swan knights, knights of the same swan that Parsifal killed in his ignorance, these knights are the secret benefactors of mankind. And there is no question in the world that the whole cycle represents the school of the adepts and its mysterious membership, and is a symbol, of course, of the invisible government of the earth seated in what the Mongolian calls Chang Shambhala, the great city of the north, the high place of the world, the Meru of India. All of these sacred mountains, the Olympus of the Greeks, the mysterious mountain of revelation, all these are the high place, or the mysterious top of the world. And even the psalmist in his extremity cries out that he shall lift up his eyes unto the hills from whence cometh his help. So these high places always represented the invisible world, or the high vibratory currents through which the messages of the needy are carried to the ears of the servants of mankind. In Buddhism, it is the gracious Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara whose large and ever attentive ears hear the sorrows, sighs, and needs of all human beings. So the knights apparently have this wonderful power to discern inwardly the requirements of everyone. Now, Gurnemanz is a kind of guide. He occurs frequently in this kind of literature. We find him in the Arthurian cycle as he appears in the form of Merlin, the wise man, the ancient one, who explains to Arthur his destiny, and who was the servant of his father. It is ancient Merlin who arranges the ordeal of the sword cast into the anvil, which is again the sword of Sigurd in the oak, the sword which, drawn forth, proves the knight to be of royal origin and kingly order. This, of course, is the sword of consciousness, which must be drawn forth out of the body before kingship can be established. In the Indian classic, it is said that it is the sword of quick detachment with which man cuts the snaky branches of the tree of illusion. And this is the good handy sword of Alexander the Great, with which he cut the Gordian knot and ended the tangle of the ages, which man in turn must also do. So this sword, later to occur again as Excalibur, the symbol of the true knighthood, the symbol of enlightened will and purpose, by which all adversaries are overcome. This sword of Merlin and all these legends and myths tie together, and Merlin finally goes to sleep in a strange castle of glass under the enchantments of Vivian, and no one sees him again. This doesn't exactly happen with Gurnemanz, but Gurnemanz is the same old guide, the same kindly one. And Jung, in his studies of psychoanalysis, points out that the dream of the old man is nearly always the dream of the teacher or the overself. So that Gurnemanz represents the strange internal overload of consciousness which man has. The great ages of experience that lie locked within his soul and are available to him when he is able to open his own inner consciousness. Perhaps this is the same meaning as Virgil leading Dante through the inferno. And in the Egyptian ritual of the dead, the mysterious being Anubis, one of the gods who leads the soul of the deceased through all the torturous passageways of Amenhotep. Always there is the guide, and he occurs in practically every one of the ancient secret orders and societies. At least he is present in the form of not an infallible one, but a kindly and learned elder knight who is past the age of battle, but is still most useful as the teacher and tutor of the coming Knights of the Grail. We are also introduced at this time to another delightful character who is more or less of an innovation, rather strongly Wagnerian, although there is some substantiation for her in other places, and that is the character of Kundry. Kundry is probably built around at least the concept of an ancient legend involving Salome. It is said that after Salome was responsible for the death of John the Baptist, a curse was placed upon her and she could not die and became the female equivalent of the wandering Jew, and therefore lived on through the ages to atone for having slain the herald or the baptizer who was to prepare the way of the Lord. In any event, Kundry seems to take upon herself a series of attributes. She is at one moment Salome. At another moment, she takes on some of the characteristics of Mary the Magdalene. And in different places and in different parts of the story, she occurs in various roles. I think we should note, of course, that her name is very interesting and reminiscent. Whether Wagner had this point in mind, we do not know, but he seems to have been the one who named her. We are not able to learn too much of any previous use of that particular name. He called her Kundry, and she was represented usually dressed in robes of serpents, or with a magnificent gown in the better operatic version, on which is embroidered or enjeweled a great serpent. The word Kundry suggests your Hindu term Kundalini, the serpent power. And this is intensified in the case of Kundry by the fact that she has a divided allegiance. When she is herself, when she is free, she strives for all that is good and wants to serve the Knights of the Grail. In fact, in the early part of the opera, she is just returning from a long journey to the most distant parts of the earth to find a medicine which will heal the wound of Amfortas. If, however, Klingsor demands it, he has the strange power of holding her in a spell of hypnosis. And when this happens, she then becomes the servant of evil. Here then, seemingly, is again a reference to the serpent power, or the Kundali Shakti of the ancient tantric magic of India. Because used for good, this serpent power becomes the agent of divinity. But used willfully for black magic or evil, it becomes a destroying force. Which also will finally destroy the person who thus abuses it. So Kundry is introduced into the story as a kind of mystery woman who seemingly is of great age, who seemingly knows all the secrets of the world, and at another moment is a very helpless, very sweet, very kind, innocent person, depending on whether she is mistress of herself at the moment, or whether she is under the spell of Klingsor. Now, we have mentioned already Amfortas and his difficulties, and of course, in the opera, it is assumed that Titurel has just died, and therefore that at the coming of the great Eucharist, the final ceremonies or rituals for him will be performed. In addition to these characters, there are several lesser ones. But for the most part, the opera moves around this group of primary persons. There are knights and retainers and, of course, a bevy of flower maidens and the inevitable ballet without which German opera at that time was not considered even remotely possible, especially when it was being paid for by the Prince of Bavaria. But in any event, the story develops around these characters. The opera begins, strangely enough, at a high point. It opens in the gardens of the Grail Castle, or on the sides of the mountains where the Grail Castle is located. And Parsifal, having wandered thus innocently and mysteriously into the assembly, and having no decent reasonable or probable answers for everything, for anything, arouses the curiosity of Gunamans. The old knight says to himself, here is certainly a person who matches all the requirements of the ancient prophecy. He is certainly ignorant, he is certainly young, he is certainly inexperienced. Perhaps he is the guileless one who is to redeem this tragedy of the Grail Knights. And hoping that thus this may be true, Gurnemans escorts, leads, and sort of pushes the young man up the long trail toward the castle of the Grail. To